Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Sonia.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, great. Let's get started.
So thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, can you hear me?
Yes, sorry. Can you hear me? It's just there's like a intermeeting beeping going on.
Huh, that's weird.
Hello? Oh, good.
Yep.
Okay.
Are you still hearing
me? I'll let you know if it keeps happening. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, let me get off of my Wi-Fi sometimes at home.
Okay.
All right, I'm ready.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us. I just wanted to get started by getting our listeners to learn a little bit more about you. So can you tell me a little bit about yourself, who you are, and a little bit about Free From and your role there?
Yeah, sorry. And of course my dog barks right at that moment. my name is Tania Ventura. I am the director of partnerships. Oh, no, I'm not. My title just changed. I am the director of service provider engagement and education at Free From. So in a nutshell, what that fancy title means is that I work with service providers who are either directly working with survivors or who are offering products and services that might be useful to the survivor population, and really help them into incorporating trauma-informed, survivor-centered financial capacity building work. So pretty much doing financial services, coaching, credit building, income development, entrepreneurship with survivors, and helping folks really think about how can that be applied in the daily works of the gender-based violence movement and IPV movement.
That's amazing. All things that I'm really bad at. So let's get everyone on the same page. In August, Free From released a report called Survivors Know Best: How to Disrupt Intimate Partner Violence During COVID-19 and Beyond. I mean, what a timely report, especially with all the reporting around the rates of domestic violence increasing during the pandemic, and, you know, all the creative advocacy that programs in the country are really being forced to engage in. So can you tell me a little bit about the report, and what did you feel like were the main takeaways?
Yeah, so the report really came out, the report just came out, but this whole initiative came out because of the COVID-19 pandemic. So when this pandemic really started back in March, I think the whole Free From team was just kind of waiting for a fund for survivors to happen. We were seeing, like, you know, funds for artists, funds for folks who were impacted by the Black Lives Matter or like arrested in Black Lives Matter protests, and really supporting the folks doing that work. We were seeing housing grants coming about, and, you know, like even like hotel vouchers for domestic violence survivors. But I think we were all kind of waiting and hoping that somebody, you know, a bigger DV organization would probably come in and do a safety fund of sorts. So a fund for survivors to get them cash that they wanted, that they needed and wanted during this time of just overall economic hardship. And when that didn't happen, we kind of like looked at each other and we're like, well, virtually looked at each other because we weren't in person, but virtually like talked to each other, you know, got on some video calls, and we're like, maybe we do this survivor safety fund. And that's kind of how it all started. So we launched a GoFundMe page to raise money to create the safety fund, which we wanted really to be flexible cash grants directly to survivors. So we didn't want it to be, you know, like gift cards of any sort that would restrict what survivors can use that money for. We wanted it to be quick and as direct as possible. So we fundraised the money through GoFundMe, and very quickly it got a lot of support from the community. And within about a couple of weeks, we were giving our first grant. Sorry.
No worries.
I'm in the fire zone over here, so.
Oh, no.
Coughing might happen a couple times. Yeah.
Of course. Please take care of yourself.
Yeah, but sorry. The coughing might happen. I'm pretty close to the fires out here in L.A., so let me know if you need me to re-record anything.
No, go ahead.
Trying to get my dogs to stop barking. But where did I... we were quickly giving
you were talking about
grants.
The GoFundMe.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we were within a couple of weeks, we were able to start giving out some of these grants. And we realized, A, that there was a huge need for these grants. Originally, we thought about, like, oh, maybe, you know, we'll just see what people are asking for, how much money they want to give. And we decided to kind of, like, have grants that were $250 max. But folks on average started asking for around $244. So we really just allowed folks to tell us what they needed in the grant application. And I think quickly realized there was a big need for funds like these, but also that we had a very interesting opportunity to collect some information about what survivors were needing in this moment in time and beyond, because a lot of the financial hardships that survivors were experiencing were happening before COVID. And if anything, COVID really illuminated and brought these hardships to light and maybe made them even worse. So we then started thinking about, well, how can we collect really meaningful information from survivors that doesn't really exist out there about their financial needs, what cash grants could do in their lives, and how that can help them recover financially from the harm that they endured. And we quickly got a lot of great information. And I'm happy to share a couple of those. One of the questions that we asked is, how much money do you need in this moment to stay safe? And the average answer that we got was about $730. So if you think about it, that's not a lot. I think some of these other misconceptions about how much money it takes to get somebody safe exist out there. And sometimes people are afraid to tackle this because it sounds like a very, very expensive problem to kind of start to address. But survivors are telling us in this moment about $730 would make a huge difference in their lives. And obviously we had a few outliers. We had folks who said more than like $100,000, and we had folks who said like $20 is all I really need. But the average was really $730. And then we also asked, like, what are your top needs right now? And the top three needs that came up were 65% of all the folks who responded to our survey was, or to the application, was 65% needed direct cash to use as they needed. 41% said utility bills. And 35% said credit and debt relief. And just to give you an idea, and I should have started with this, but we collected over about 1,300 survey responses from survivors. And the way that we collected that was that it was an application for the fund, which had some required fields. The only required fields were your name, are you a survivor, and how do we communicate with you safely, if at all, if there is any safe way to communicate with you, and how do we disperse this cash to you safely. That's it. That's all that was required. Everything else was optional, and
that's
we made
great.
That very,
really
very
low,
clear.
Low barrier.
Yeah, exactly. And we wanted to do that because we knew that as people with lived experience, like most of our team are survivors, we knew that there are so many obstacles to like kind of manage when you're trying to seek support. You know, like you have to have a certain amount of income. You have to prove how you're going to use certain aid or getting very restrictive support. And we knew that survivors were going to come kind of expecting that experience again, to have to prove yourself, to have to retell your story, all that. And we really wanted to undo that and really make this as easy as possible to navigate and to access. So all the rest of the questions were optional, and we made it very clear to folks so that if they didn't want to give us more information about what their needs were, what they were experiencing, like how we can be supportive as a movement and how we can continue to kind of support their financial needs. Some folks, I think, really appreciated that level of honesty and that level of option. And I think that's why we got so many responses and were able to collect some of this very amazing data.
Yeah, it really is amazing because I feel like it's hard to collect data like this. It's just so great that, you know, you were able to engage with folks who were getting real assistance. So, mm-hmm. you know, when I was reading through the report, I know you and I talked about this a little bit before, but I talked about NRCDV's housing work. So NRCDV is actually part of this Federal Domestic Violence Housing Technical Assistance Consortium, which is a collaborative joint agency consortium that is providing training, technical assistance, and resources at the intersection of domestic violence, sexual violence, housing, and homelessness. So I think about that lens a lot. Mm-hmm. So I saw that housing mm-hmm. came up in a lot of different ways in the report. So can you tell me a little bit about, you know, how that came up as a theme? You know, what did you feel about it?
Yeah. The housing conversation to me is always like an and, but, or, and, you know, yes, maybe. It's like a very complicated conversation because there's so many intersections when it comes to housing. But in this specific report, housing was actually not one of the biggest things that folks selected as a need in the moment. And that might be a little bit because of what's happening with COVID, but also I think it's because I think when we talk about housing, we often forget like the need to sustain housing. So it's one thing to get housing, but then how do you stay in it, right? And like, how do you continue to be able to stay housed and not just housed, but how do you find housing that feels safe to you? And it's, you know, it becomes a bigger conversation then. So I think what we saw more was folks were reporting, you know, like things like using the cash for utility bills. Obviously, that's going to allow somebody to maybe make rent or some folks maybe were struggling, like, should I pay rent this month? Should I take utility bills this month? If I don't pay my utility bills, what happens then to my lease? And a lot of the folks that we surveyed or that participated in this safety fund said that they were actually renting, whether it was a room, whether it was an apartment or a home, but they were renters. So you can imagine how like having $250 to use for some immediate needs could impact the longevity of being able to sustain housing. Those are $250 that aren't coming out of your rent and maybe are allowing you to kind of handle some of these other pending financial matters that maybe paying rent wouldn't have allowed you to do or would have put your rent into would have jeopardized your ability to pay rent.
Yeah, no, I think it's such an important point because this model of like flexible funding for housing has gotten really popular where programs will provide, you know, a small grant as you all did or, you know, a small lump of funding for survivors to stay housed versus, you know, the initial finding housing to begin with, you know, entering through the whole system I think that we know when people are safely housed and they're stably housed, you know, they can focus on their safety, they can focus on their healing and focus on anything else they need to in the rest of their lives.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think just allowing folks to define what that safety means too, like, you know, like having access to financial resources gives you more options. It gives you the option if you want to stay in a home, but maybe, you know, the abuse is something that can be safely tackled or safely addressed within that home, then that allows the survivor to maybe start having their own money while they're in that relationship to figure out what exactly they want to do here. Do they want to stay? Do they want to go? For the folks that do leave, having that cash can be significant as well because, you know, they can start saving for a long-term apartment or maybe they're staying in shelter and they want to get a car to be able to get a job, which then will lead them to getting housed. So it just has so many implications beyond, I think, what we sometimes think it will have.
Yeah, and I want to thank you for bringing that point up. I think that lots of times we forgot that safety looks really different for everyone, and people are really incredible at understanding what they need. So when survivors tell us, you know, what they need to stay safe, and we listen, you know, it ultimately means safety for them, their families, their communities, and it happens a lot faster than sometimes if, you know, we're more prescriptive about what they're supposed to do.
Yeah, absolutely.
Another part of the report that I thought was really interesting was the last half of the report has a whole section on expanding the ecosystem of support for survivors. So can you tell me, you know, what Free From means when you say an ecosystem of support, and what does that ecosystem look like?
Yeah, of course. So I think, like, we talked a little bit about, like, the numbers that were exciting that came from this report, but I think two of the large, like, general takeaways that came from this report were, one, we have to trust survivors when they're telling us what they need, similar to what you just said. Like, they are the experts in their own lives, and they are the best to tell us, you know, what kind of services, what kind of support that they want and need. And then second is that we have to build an ecosystem of support for survivors. So one of the interesting things that we were able to do through this grant, through those optional questions that I was talking about, was ask survivors which of these kind of communities or organization types or, like, company types have you sought support from. And there was things like domestic violence organizations, shelters, banks, religious institutions, and all sorts of, like, different community stakeholders, as you might call it. And what we learned is a lot of folks are going to domestic violence organizations. And a lot of folks would go to other places if they knew that they could offer them support. Or for the folks at banks or religious institutions, they went and they weren't able to receive the support that they needed. But if that changed, then they would actually try to receive support. So I think overall, one of the things that is important to talk about is IPD as a systemic and structural economic issue. It's not just something that happens within a bubble, right? It's not just something that all of a sudden happens and it's a crisis. And I think oftentimes our society's response to IPD is short-term, fleeting, and often because it's short-term and fleeting, doesn't really create a holistic system of support for the person that was harmed that allows them to heal and move on and create financial stability for themselves or recover financial stability for themselves. So when we say ecosystem of support for survivors, we mean that there are more people in our community and more folks in our society that have a responsibility in helping survivors recover from harm. So this shouldn't just fall on the domestic violence movement or the IPD movement. Banks have a place in this solution. For example, a lot of harm doers use banks to abuse folks through their finances, right? Like, they withhold bank account information. They withhold paychecks. We know what happens there. So if we can bring banks into the conversation and help banks really create banking products and services that are survivor-informed, that help banking become, like, safer, easier, and more affordable for survivors, then survivors might feel safe going to their banking team. And being honest, like, hey, this person who's harming me is not allowing me to access my bank account. What can I do to regain that safety and regain access to that bank account? And how wonderful would it be if that bank person knew exactly what to do and knew exactly how to help that person regain that economic safety? Then we might avoid something really escalating to a crisis point and then not having enough resources to really address that crisis fully. Similar for religious institutions. A lot of folks will go to a religious institution before they go to, like, any other service, right, because they want that religious-specific support. And what if religious leaders had the tools in order to support that survivor, regain economic security or regain safety, and again, prevent that crisis moment from happening. So it really means that all of us have a place and a role in really holding survivors and giving survivors a space to recover, to heal, and create safer futures for themselves, their families, and their communities.
No, I think that's such an important point. And I mean, just describing what it'd be like to, you know, go to your religious institution, go to the bank, go anywhere, and people are all concerned with each other's safety. Like, that's a place that I want to live in, and that's a place that, you know, could easily help survivors get support.
Yeah, so, I agree. I want to live there, too.
So earlier you talked a little bit about your safety fund. You talked about the application. But what I'd love to know more about is the ways that you are building trust with survivors. Like, you are still a mysterious organization on the internet, and, you know, survivors have to go through this online application process. You know, how are you trust building? What do you feel like has been successful? And, you know, what can you share from that experience?
Yeah. I didn't know we were mysterious online. Let me know how we can fix that, because maybe y'all are feeling we're mysterious,
like,
and maybe there's some things we can do
online.
Yeah. Well, let us know if y'all have ideas about how we can be less mysterious. But I think one of the biggest things that we do is we really want to create services, products, anything that really much we do that is survivor driven. So that means survivors are driving what we do. And that starts with who we hire. And on our team is mostly, like I mentioned earlier, a team of survivors who are bringing our own experiences and passion to this work. So I think that's a crucial and important part in really building products and services that are going to be survivor driven and informed. Secondly, is we pay a lot of attention to language and how we are presenting things. So we try to use inclusive language. So language that includes folks from varying different backgrounds, varying different genders, varying different sexualities, cultural backgrounds, identities. And we try to make sure that our language reflects that. We try to use language that is people-centered, so people before their identity, right? So I'm a human first, and everything else that's about me is part of my identity. So my name is Sonia Ventura. I'm a human. I am also a survivor. I am also queer. I am also Latina. So centering the human and understanding that all these other experiences are part of their identity. We use language that tries to, which this one is new for me, so I might have messed up on this podcast already, but that is nonviolent. So we really try to use language that doesn't sound violent. So I'm not using things like break or fight, or just words that maybe subconsciously continue to either re-traumatize somebody or continue to play on this narrative of, like, violence being incorporated into our society. Like a big piece of our society is violence, and that sometimes comes up in our language. As well as just being really honest and flexible about how we are asking for things, what we're asking for, and how we are communicating with survivors. So an example of that is there were questions on our application that were mandatory, right? Those are things that we need to know to get the money to you. And then there are things that we honestly don't really need to know, but we are just curious about. And if you could help us, that would be wonderful, because then we can make a case for doing this kind of work in our society in general. We can go to funders and be like, we have the numbers that we have been missing for years about why this type of work is important. We can go to government agencies and so on and so forth. So being very honest about why we're asking for these things and giving folks the option to opt in or opt out, and also kind of giving them that choice. So making it very clear that this is your choice. Eligibility is not going to be like, the way that you answer these questions isn't gonna have anything to do with whether you're gonna qualify or get this grant, because that's not what we're doing here. This is just what we are interested in kind of learning more about, so that we can continue to do this type of work and help this movement advocate for this kind of work. So being really honest about that, and I think that really carries out into all the programs and services that we offer. Right now, obviously, we're working with a lot of folks virtually, so all our, like, our training program uses those same type of standards of, like, language that's inclusive, language that centers humans first, language that's nonviolent, and then trauma-informed practices, so being flexible. So if somebody changes their mind about how they want to be communicated with, totally fine, let's change it. If somebody, for some reason, you know, we don't hear from them for a week, doesn't mean that, they don't want to maybe talk to us. It just means that whatever's going on in their life is going on. And when they do talk to us again, then re-engaging in that conversation. Being flexible about how folks were getting their money. So maybe on their application they said they wanted it via PayPal, but it turns out they actually need it via Venmo, and then being able to accommodate for those needs. So I think that flexibility, that honesty, that those language considerations really helps us build trust with survivors in a virtual way that that sometimes I think we kind of fear that we might not be able to do when you're not really talking to a person. But I think all those considerations folks notice, and I think it was like 60 people actually gave us feedback saying that they noticed that all those like efforts that we made with our language, with the way that we just create the whole experience, and that really helped folks trust us and trust that what we really wanted to do was help them. And I think that's what allowed them to kind of engage with more of the questions and answer them.
That's incredible. You know, I think the domestic violence field, intimate partner violence field, the anti-violence field, they always talk about, you know, trauma-informed practices. They talk about low barrier and no barrier, you know, forms or applications or trainings or you know, whatever they're applying that to. And you're really putting it into practice. So I commend you on that. And I think it's just, it's fantastic. And I'm so thrilled to have been connected with you and Free From. So overarching question, how does Free From support survivors and the service providers that support them?
Yeah, thank you. That's a great question. So Free From does so many things, right, outside of the safety fund. Our mission is to dismantle the nexus between gender-based violence and economic insecurity. I think we all know the reasons why financial insecurity plays such a big role in the cycle of violence. And I think Free From is really trying to fill that gap. And I think we're slowly becoming the experts, which feels weird sometimes to me. Like, oh, when did we become experts? But I think we're slowly becoming the experts in like how to approach financial work through a trauma-informed lens and through a lens that allows us to really connect with survivors and really support survivors in a meaningful way. My specific work is to support service providers. As you mentioned, one of the things that we do is support service providers. And the reason why we support service providers is because we're learning that about 50 to 60% of all service providers working in the domestic violence movement are survivors themselves. And many of them are reporting the same to similar economic challenges as the people that they serve. So we see service providers as this population of survivors that maybe isn't receiving the services that they need and the support that they need. So we really want to invest in the people doing this work so that financial capacity building or financial empowerment, or financial literacy or entrepreneurship, whatever word you want to use for it, wealth building, becomes more incorporated into the movement. So when you invest in the people doing the work, then they have the capacity to invest in the people that they are serving. You know, burnout is real. Forgetting to self-care is real in this moment, in this movement, and in this moment. And how can we as Free From really support service providers and helping them, give them a safe space to learn about finances, but also work on their own financial goals, on their own financial worries, financial challenges, so that we're not accidentally, you know, subconsciously maybe passing some of these financial challenges or financially harmful mindsets to our clients. So really giving survivors, whether they are a client or a service provider, that space. So we do training. We train organizations on our curriculum, which, like I mentioned, is survivor-informed, trauma-informed. We train them virtually. We partner with them for a year. And we train organizations on how to do financial work in your organization through your existing programs in a way that is meaningful. So an organization maybe realized, oh, you know, we're not really screening for work experience when somebody moves into our shelter. How can we start talking to folks about, like, are you interested in work? And have you thought about entrepreneurship or just things that might be helpful to a survivor or, like, during intake? Or maybe an organization realizes we do have a lot of staff members that are survivors and we really want to offer them better salaries or higher salaries. How do we as an organization work towards that goal so that we can offer our staff higher salaries? And we've worked with different organizations in different capacities, but for the most part, each organization has its own like experience with our training and come out with their own goals on how they want to use this training, either for themselves as like people, you know, like I am a service provider and I have a lot of debt and I want to learn how to manage my debt or work with my debt so that I can then do that with a client. Or maybe it's I'm a service provider and I have this client who is undocumented and I have no clue how to help them build income. Like how do I do that? And then we help them through that. So that's what really this training is for, is to teach those kind of like softer financial skills like credit, debt, income building, but also coaching service providers on like how to do this work with themselves and with others. And then we have our Compensation Compass, which is an amazing, amazing online tool that everybody, I hope, uses. But it's a really comprehensive, it's almost like a quick self-guided survey that asks survivors questions about
tell people how to find it if they want to go to it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so you can find it on our website, the www.freefrom.org. www.freefrom.org. And you click on the top, and it says Get Compensation. So you click on that, and then I'll take you to the Compensation Compass. And it works for anybody living in a U.S. state. And it'll ask you questions about, you know, what is the harm you experience? What kind of compensation are you looking for? You know, things like, are you comfortable seeing the person that harmed you in court? All sorts of questions. And at the end, it will give you, like, self-help steps and almost like a guide on how to seek avenues of compensation, whether that's through small claims court, whether that's through civil litigation, whether that's through victims of crime funding. And it'll give you all the steps that you need and state specific information on how to do that yourself. So that's a really great tool. And I think a lot of survivors really like that you can go on there. You don't have to walk into like any sort of like building that makes it seem that you're seeking support. And it's really like self-help, self-made type of support that is meaningful to the folks looking for that kind of support. We also have peer-to-peer groups, financial groups, which are community-led groups of survivors that come together and decide that they want to, you know, start a peer-to-peer support group related to finances. So every support group is different, and they all decide to meet on whatever times work for them. They're at varying different sizes. They are happening all over the nation. And all it really takes is for a group of survivors to come and tell Freefrom, hey, we're a group of survivors. We really want to do more around supporting each other with finances. Can you help us start a group? Wonderful. We will send that group a guide on how to start a group. A toolkit on how to start that group, which includes resources, which includes sample agendas, which includes topic, like conversation topics, so that group can really operate independently of any organization or any of us and really take into consideration what the needs of those survivors are. And the reason why we took that model is because there's a lot of survivors out in this country that maybe don't have an organization near them or maybe don't know where to go or don't feel comfortable walking into a DV or an IPV organization or calling an IPV or DV organization. And we believe that those folks should still have resources and access to community to build meaningful wealth for themselves and their communities. So that's why we took that peer-to-peer approach to really help survivors, support survivors. And survivors are geniuses. Like, we are amazing. Like, we've come up with some very creative and wonderful ways to survive in some conditions that maybe not everybody has been able to survive in. So really understanding that survivors, again, know best, kind of like our report is called, we know best, and that when we're allowed to share our knowledge and when we are allowed to create collective power with other survivors, that it can really be magical and create some amazing, amazing communities and support. We do a lot of banking work. So we talked about the banking world, right, where banks would be able to support survivors. Sorry. Where banks would be able to support survivors when they walk in and say, you know, like, my harm doer is not letting me access my bank account. So we created some banking guidelines to help banks create services and products that are safer, easier, and more affordable for survivors that you can also access on our website by going to the news tab. And then we are launching a survivor worker safety lab. So thinking about how a lot of employers probably employ survivors, right? Even us in the nonprofit world, or even us in the domestic violence movement and IPV movement, a lot of us employ survivors. And how do we create, like, work environments that are safe, supportive, and accessible to survivors? So thinking about, like, what policies we can put in place, what kind of practices can we put into place to make workspaces more accessible to survivors? So we're really looking for organizations, both in the nonprofit and the private sector, who want to work with us on, like, maybe launching, like, a paid leave policy for survivors. So for folks who go to their employer and disclose that they are a survivor and are experiencing some sort of harm and need time off from work, piloting some sort of policy that allows folks to take that time off and be paid during that time, and seeing how that affects the company, right, and making that argument that this is actually a good idea to do. So the Survivor Work Safety Lab will be working on more ideas like that, and will be led by survivors and by the voices of survivors and by the thoughts of survivors to come up with some sort of, like, we're calling the Survivor Manifesto for now, but kind of like these guidelines and ideas about how work can be safer, accessible, and more supportive to survivors. And I think that's amazing. In a nutshell, everything we're doing. Yeah.
Yeah, only a little bit of work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's incredible. I feel so thrilled to know all the different projects that you're working on. You know, I know about the report, and I knew a little bit from reading your news blog on the website and things like that, but it's just so interesting how there's so many mm-hmm. different ways that survivors are able to engage with you and companies are able to engage with you.
Yeah.
And I know, so we talked earlier about, you know, just financial abuse and how it's a common part of IPV and it happens more frequently than not, and survivors often need money
mm-hmm.
or some avenue to safety. But what is something that service providers working with survivors can do now to incorporate more financial capacity
mm-hmm.
building into their lives and work?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest things you can do is take care of yourself. And give yourself that space to explore your own relationship to money before you can kind of really begin to talk about this with survivors, maybe in a more formal way. And what I mean by that is talking about finances is very scary for a lot of us for many varying reasons. And it's new, and we know that it's new. Like, a lot of these financial services and capacity building kind of, you know, even all these words are pretty new in the domestic violence and IPV world. And I think we have to allow ourselves to feel whatever we're going to feel when these conversations come up. You know, like, am I feeling scared? Am I feeling confused? Am I feeling nervous? Am I just like, nope, I'm not doing it. Like, that's not something that I'm going to do in this movement. But allow yourself to feel all that and really take care of those feelings and give those feelings time so that you can understand where they're coming from. Because like I said, a lot of us have lived experience with domestic violence, right, or IPV, or sexual assault, or many types of gender-based violence. Or we know somebody who was impacted by it, and therefore, you know, maybe we have some secondary trauma there. So a lot of us have this lived experience, and not a lot of space to work on it or to heal it or to talk to it or to engage with it. So I think that that's one of the biggest things you can do is take care of yourself and allow yourself to have these critical conversations within you. Once you're ready, you can reach out to organizations like us, or you can start doing a lot of self-learning about finances. Like, what is it that sometimes learning about something that you're scared of or maybe worried about or confused about can really help feel it less scary or less confusing or less worrisome. So then starting to see what feels safe to learn and what are ways that I can learn more about this. Like I said, we're one of those resources, but there are many resources online. Like, you can probably Google anything you want online, like what is debt or what exactly is a credit score? And there's videos and there's articles and all those things to help. And then once you're actually ready to start doing this work, it's thinking about, okay, well, what is my role in this movement, right? Am I an advocate? Am I a hotline staff member? Am I working in the shelter? Am I a therapist? What is your role, right? And how does finances come into play in your role? Like, where does it come up? How are the folks that you're working with bringing it up? Is it being brought up by other teammates? You know, is this something that's impacting your team? And really thinking about, like, how can I start addressing these financial pieces in a way that's meaningful for me? So, for example, if you're working in a shelter and you're doing intake, is there any questions I can ask at intake that could help us support a survivor create long-term financial safety? Like, maybe it's just one little question. Maybe it's two. Maybe it's three. If you're a hotline staff member and you're helping somebody create a safety plan, is there any financial safety planning that I can incorporate into that? So, like, making sure folks, like, gather any documents about finances or try to get access to a bank account that maybe they haven't looked at in a long time. So, you know, thinking about, like, how do I make some of these things that I'm learning meaningful in the work that I'm doing? So I think those three things, taking care of yourself because you are important and this movement wouldn't exist without you. Second, learning in a way that feels safe to you, learning about the things that you don't know and being okay with saying, no, I don't know. I don't know what credit is. Let me Google it really quick and see if I can learn a little bit about it. And then third, finding ways to incorporate into your work that's meaningful but not overwhelming. You know, like, you don't have to recreate a whole new job. You can do little things within the work that you're doing to incorporate some financial capacity building in your work with survivors.
That is all incredible advice. I can't really think of a better way to wrap up the conversation together, but I know we have a couple minutes left, so I just wanted to ask you, if there's anything else that you want to share with our listeners about, you know, the work that you do, about Free From, about you, any other advice that you have for advocates that you want to share that you didn't get a chance to cover today?
Yeah. I want you all to know that Free From is a resource for service providers and for people doing this work. I think we work more with service providers than a lot of people realize. Like, a lot of our work is service provider to service provider support. I am your colleague. I am your supporter. I am your advocate. I am your coach. So please, 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 if you have any questions about finances, if you're hesitant about where to start, if you're curious about, like, how do we get our organization trained, or how does our organization even start to have some of these financial conversations or start having some of these larger, like, how do we incorporate survivor safety into our workplace? Please let us know and reach out. We are available for you and we are a resource to you.
Well, thank you so much. It was truly a joy to talk to you today. I feel like I learned so much about Free From and your work, and I'm really excited for your collaborations with all these programs and all these organizations and, you know, all the support that you've provided survivors. So thank you again for taking the time to talk to me today, and I'm looking forward to all of our listeners learning more about you and Free From.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me and for bearing with me through all the barks and all the coughing and everything. So thank you so much. I really, really appreciate being on here, and I hope that, you know, this is meaningful for the folks that listen.
Of course. Thank you so much. Talk soon. Bye.
All right. Bye.
Thank you.